July 9th, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we will have a discussion on Cleodynamics, a new science of socioeconomic and political trend and event prediction. Now, contrary to popular belief, this discipline was not spawned by Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, that's Harry Seldon's plan, but it is very reminiscent of it. One of the founders is Peter Turchin, a biologist at the University of Connecticut, who has written a book called War and Peace and War, in which he examines the rise and fall of empires on the Cleodynamic scale. Now, this book invites comparison to Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West, which was avidly read by Adolf Hitler and George W. Bush and his neocons. It was the Machiavelli of the 19th century. Now, Cleodynamics uses Malthusian mathematical formulas to predict economic and political events. Now, tonight we're going to have, as our distinguished guest on this rather deep subject, Dr. Troy Camplin, who is an interdisciplinary scholar living in Richardson, Texas. He's the author of the book Diaphysics, a Work of Systems Philosophy, and several articles and topics ranging from economics and technology to the sociology of artistic production. What unifies the majority of his scholarly work is the spontaneous order theory. He has a PhD in the humanities from UT Dallas, a master's in English from the University of Southern Mississippi, and a BA in recombinant gene technology from Western Kentucky University. He's just the person to fill us in on this Cleodynamics discipline. Now, I ended up my abstract by saying, so if you want to know what the boys in the think tanks are reading, tune in and we will invoke the muse of history. By the way, the muse of history is Cleo, and that's where Cleodynamics comes from. Dr. Camplin, are you on board?
I am.
Oh, well, we're honored to have you. Now, you sent us some talking points here, but before we get going here, there's a couple of questions I would like to ask you. Looking over your little bio, which I just read, it looks to me like you are familiar with, and I'm wondering how much influence this may have on Cleodynamics, von Bertalanffy's general systems theory. You're what?
Yes, I'm quite familiar with Bertalanffy.
Yeah, it looks to me like that might be one of your might be in your background, definitely. And also, I mentioned Oswald Spengler, and I should have also mentioned Gibbon, but it's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And as you know, as people who have tried to do this in the past. And, you know, Marx, Karl Marx also, and whatever. So the first one of your points was Cleodynamics and kind of describing it for us. I don't think Peter Turchin actually founded it. It just looks to me like a Russian, like there were some Russians that actually started it off. Is that true?
It has a somewhat unique background and therefore approach to it. He has a background in mathematical ecology. And so he wondered what would happen if he applied those methods to the study of history. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of asking, you know, well, shouldn't we treat human societies as ecosystems? And if we do that, you know, what would happen if we use the same sort of mathematical models that we use in ecosystems dynamics. And so that's sort of the unique thing that he brings to
it. Your sound quality is kind of bad. You're not breaking up exactly, but you know what I think you might be a good idea would be for you to sign off and call back in, because maybe we get a better connection. You're talking on a cell phone, aren't you?
All right, let me give that a shot.
What? Landline or cell phone? Troy, are you talking on a landline or a cell phone? I assume he's going to call back in. Well, while he's calling back in, Michael Beeson, are you there?
I certainly am, Punk.
Oh, you are? Good. Yeah, well, Troy, it's very interesting what he's saying, but we can't, Troy, are you back?
I am back.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is any better.
Yeah, I think does sound a little better. It sounds a little better. It was kind of staticky there for a while. So you had first in the line was to kind of explain what Cleo Dynamics is, and you had macro history as a subtopic there. And secular cycles versus economic cycles. I've looked at some of the formulas of this thing, and one of these people is predicting doomsday. I think it's 2020 or something like that, and he has an actual date on it. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, because we used to have a kind of a humorous thing called the Doom of the Month Club. And the idea was you join the Doom of the Month Club and we give you a free doom when you join up, you know, and because you get a doom every month, you know. And our free doom that we had was the Chinese duck poop doom, because the ducks poop in the rice paddies in southern China, and all of the Chinese coolies have to smoke cigarettes, mostly American cigarettes, to keep their to kill the parasites from the duck poop that they get in their lungs, and so if the cigarettes don't kill them, the duck poop does, and so we were going to offer that as a free doom. You join the Tomb of the Month Club. What do you think about this predicting the apocalypse?
Well, he's not really predicting an apocalypse per se. What he's done is he's done an analysis of history, and he's discovered that in the United States, not just in the United States, but in sort of modern era countries like the United States, there seems to be a 50-year what he calls secular cycle. In the United States, the last one was in 1970, and certainly around that time there was a whole lot of political violence within the country. Yeah, the late 60s and on through the 70s was a great deal of political violence. And he points out, too, the period before that, where there was a lot of political violence, was 1920.
Yeah.
And that's sort of sufficiently far back that people forget. But, in fact, that was a period of great political violence.
Mm-hmm.
Go back another 50 years, and that is 1870. And, well, what happened in the 1860s? that was the American Civil War.
Right.
A great deal of political violence, to say the least. And in the aftermath, there was a great deal of political violence as well. And he, of course, we can go back to 1776. the 1770s, another time of political violence.
So it goes in these 100-year cycles.
Well, about 50-year cycles.
Yeah.
You know, we... there's also 1920.
Yeah.
That he noted that there was this big peak. So if that's the case, then we would expect, you know, if there was, 1970, 1920, 1970, then the next cycle should peak around 2020. So it's not really sort of a ticking clock, but it's more of a, we should expect there to be the same kinds of tensions giving rise to an increase in political violence around that time period.
Well, I can certainly relate to that. I'm an old special warfare school graduate. We had when I was in, we had a number of European instructors from Central Europe who had gone through all of that partisan activity during World War II and the political unrest leading up to it. And they had a formula. They said, when hardcore unemployment reaches 15%, the shooting starts. And I remember that. I remember one of these old Czechoslovakian guys writing that on the blackboard. And of course, we got right now. Looks like in this country we have more than that as hardcore unemployment. And so, but the, and predictably, the shootings is starting all over the place. So I guess maybe maybe there's something to these predictions. The Malthusian aspect of it, I know, I just been, by the way, before you called, I got Turchin's book, War and Peace and War, and I managed to get through the introduction. And what do you think about his Azabia theory?
What theory is that again?
It's Azabia. He gets it from Ibn Khaldun, who was a Muslim, kind of a Muslim philosopher and commentator back as I recall, in the 9th century or something like that. And Ibn Khaldun came up with this theory about, he called it Azabia. It was sort of the charisma of the group. And kind of a group charisma or group baraka, something like that. And Turchin seems to make a lot out of that. And he seems to think that religion is a very definite factor that should be factored into cleodynamic predictions, the way I gather it. And of course, that would certainly bear out, you know, the sort of thing that we're experiencing in the Middle East right now. And also it would bear out some of Carl Jung's theories, you know, that religion is something that people sort of have to have. How does that figure into cleodynamics?
Well, something like religion, especially, I mean, if we look at it historically, religions have this tendency to unite groups. And there have been some particular religions that have been particularly good at it. Obviously, you know, some obvious ones being Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam do a spectacular job of uniting huge groups of people. And you start to get sort of large groups of people who are thinking the same way, believing the same way. And of course, this is also then in tension with various political realities, differences in language, differences in culture, and so you very often have those kinds of tensions. There's both uniting and division, depending upon what level of you're looking at. Example, in Europe, unification under Christianity, but also then division, political divisions.
Yeah, one of the power that groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda have, primarily using children and actually training them, training children. And I mentioned one time that this business of making people from the time they're 7 years old get down on the floor and put their head down and pray five times a day is a form of brainwashing and ends up as a form of mind control. So what you really have is a bunch of people that are just brainwashed into I think. Now that's, of course, you know, you have to realize my perspective, of course, is take a special forces perspective on this thing, so I'm a bit hostile to that. But but then on the other hand, it is effective. It's very effective. And I had a Jewish friend who was in a think tank, and he was asking me, he was suggesting that the Arabs were, that it was all economic, you know. No, there was no religion. The religion doesn't really mean anything. And I said, wait a minute. And right. I think by now he's changed his mind. So it does have a lot to do with it. So we have macro history is to micro history as macroeconomics is to microeconomics, and this, of course, is in our Hermetic perspective, microcosm, macrocosm, as above, so below. This fits right in. So you want to talk about that a little bit?
That equation is very important because. The vast majority of economics that is done is, of course, microeconomics. It's dealing with sort of individuals and their interactions with each other. Then you also have macroeconomics, which in its current, you know, permutation may not even qualify entirely as a science, but... The understanding that there is a macro level is important, and there are some things that are happening in complexity science, in agent-based modeling, and that sort of thing that are actually starting to move macroeconomics in the right direction, self-organization theory and that sort of thing. The fortunate thing, Cleo Dynamics seems to sort of be introducing a macro history on top of the way the history is done now, which is micro history, interest in, you know, this particular king or that particular ruler or this important pope, or even more recently, interest in less, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, important people or you know, people who aren't elites, for example. And sort of learning sort of cultural history and that sort of thing. But even that then is sort of micro history. It's looking at how these individuals are living and looking at the history of those individuals. What Turchin is doing is he's introducing a sort of macro history and looking at sort of these forces in a bigger sense. Microeconomics the models for microeconomics are based on equilibrium theory. And again, this makes sense as far as it goes for individuals. You have things sort of reaching an equilibrium. You have negative feedback, dampening things out. Macroeconomics, if you look at things sort of on the bigger scale, what you have is positive feedback. Positive feedback are sort of runaway things. It results in cycles and that sort of thing. And indeed, that's what we see in the economy. We see cycles in the economy. We see economic cycles of boom and bust, and we see, you know, any number of other cycles. And this is what Turchin is discovering, are these historical cycles, and they're based on this idea of positive feedback. Positive feedback always leads to these boom and bust cycles.
Yeah. Yeah, the
I was fishing around for an analogy here to general systems theory, because it seems to have some relation to that. The microcosm, you know, microcosm, macrocosm idea. And I know what I was fishing for. Matthew's theory. Matthew's theory, and that's one of the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And this is one of the things Truchin is saying causes the collapse of empires, and that's one he is certainly right about. And the British, you probably know this, but the British Empire at right before World War II, they 10% of the people in Britain had 90% of the wealth, and they were just about ready to collapse, and actually. You know, it wasn't World War II that put them in the dumps. It was they were just about ready to go out at that time. And the same thing is happening in this country. We have almost 90% of the wealth in the hands of about 10% of the people.
Turchin actually. He points out that sort of the situation, that part of the situation, but there's another part of the situation, which is the overproduction of elites. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the United States right now. Now, what does he mean by overproduction of elites? Well, imagine that you, and this is where sort of economics and history are sort of coinciding here. What we see right now in the United States is we have something like 50% of the population or more now going to college. And part of that is being driven by sort of artificially cheap interest rates for student loans so that more and more people can go to college. The problem is that with more people going to college and bringing these student loans, the universities are charging more and more and more and more and more. And so the student loans are actually what are driving the very high cost of going to college nowadays.
Yeah, the student loans, you're making slaves out of these kids.
Well, yes, and that's another aspect of it. But think about this. We have, you know, more than half of the population going to college. They're graduating. Some of them, when they realize that they can't get jobs, then go get a master's degree. And some of those, you know, then go on, like myself, and go get a PhD. And what's happening more and more is that people are finding that they're not able to get jobs that they were educated for. And I'm not talking about, you know, somebody who's majoring in women's studies or something. I'm talking about people, you know, majoring in business and business, you know, getting a master's in business administration. And in fact, even now there are law schools starting to go out of business because there's such a glut of lawyers.
Yeah.
So you have this situation where the United States is producing more and more and more very educated people who are not able to get jobs that very often that require a college education.
This group is forming their own 15% of the unemployment, and they're doing their own kind of shooting because they're very dissatisfied. And that's a very dissatisfied group of people, I know. And thanks for bringing that forward, because that's something I hadn't. You know, we get into all these big discussions about what Monsanto is doing with food and all of that, and we forget about situations like this, because this is really important, the disparity in this thing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Desperately.
Yeah, and not only that, you have this group of people who are very educated and either unemployed or underemployed or feel like they're sort of misallocated human resources. You know, they're not doing what they were trained to do. And they're doing stuff that they didn't need to go to college to do. So you have that huge group of people. On the other hand, you also have a whole bunch of people who are successful, very, very successful. But the funny thing about people who are financially successful is that after a while they get to thinking to themselves, gee, I've, you know, accomplished so much, I'm now a multimillionaire or multibillionaire, I think I'll go into politics. You know, give back to my community by going into government, going into politics.
Yeah.
So here's another way that you overproduce elites. So we have all of these people who are very wealthy and now want to go into politics. And, I mean, think about the Republican pool right now, for crying out loud. Is what at least 13 people have declared already?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a third. That's a lot of people.
How, you know, I understand that 55% of the population are on food stamps, and I'm wondering how many of the highly educated poor are in that category too, you know?
Yeah, and think about how resentful you would be. It's like, okay, I have this college degree, so I know a lot, you know. For more than that, they've been taught all sorts of things about, you know, the unfairness of the free market economy and you know, that, you know, the exploitation of the workers and exploitation of this group and that group and every other group under the sun. So everybody's a victim. And so now they're in a situation where it's like, okay, I have this degree, I've gone to college, I can't find a job, I'm on food stamps. Heck, I am a victim. You know, I can...
Right.
I empathize with that. You know, why wouldn't you feel like a victim?
Well,
have you
I
been told
believe them? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with you. We have a tremendous number of very discontented people in this country, and that goes right across the class, that all the way down from the so-called upper class, whatever that is, all the way down to the... I don't think we have an upper class anymore. We have a rich class and then a poor educated class and then a poor uneducated class. But everybody seems to be discontented about something.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Now, if you want to know what, you know, so this is a situation on the ground, and this is a situation that Peter Turchin claims leads to periods of strong political violence. In fact, before I discovered Cleo Dynamics, back in 2011, I had written this article that's published at the Pope Center called Egypt's Revolution in Higher Education.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, I pointed out that, for example, in Egypt, the median age is 24. More than 25% of the population is attended or has attended the university. About 50% of those people have dropped out. And university education in Egypt is free. So, you know, there's an incentive to go. It's free. And the incentive is even more. More than that, if you graduated from the university, you were guaranteed a government job.
Yeah.
Which, of course, works out until you run out of government jobs.
Yeah. And what period are you talking about here?
This isn't today.
But not today,
In 2011, Egypt's unemployment rate was about the same as the United States, about 9%.
Yeah.
But 87.2% of the unemployed were between the ages of 15 and 29. And the biggest group that were unemployed were those with basically, unemployment among Egyptian college graduates was 10 times higher than those who did not go to college.
Yeah.
That was the situation right before they overthrew Mubarak.
Well, while we're creating, we are realizing tonight, and I hope we're enlightening some people listening, that that this situation is generating a huge reservoir of discontent, and that reservoir of discontent can reach an explosive condition. If it continues, and something has to be, I think something has to be done about this. Now, this is the point that's been made about Cleo Dynamics and some of the things that I've read, according to some critics, it has a conspiratorial aspect, because if you are in tune with it, and if you use it, then you know when to manipulate. This, of course, was, and I said to begin with, in the abstract, when we started off on the show, I said that Cleo Dynamics did not grow out of Asimov's foundation. But I think it did, because he opens up his introduction to War and Peace and War with a description of Harry Seldon and the plan. That's where he starts out. But you remember that the Second Foundation, they were the manipulators. They ran the plan. They ran the mathematics. They had the big computers, and they knew how to manage events. Now, Truchin or somebody says that Asimov didn't know about the butterfly effect, but I don't. But he certainly knew something like the butterfly effect, because, as you know, the outgrowth of the butterfly effect is okay. Let's go kill the kill the butterfly before he does something, before he causes an apocalypse. And the Second Foundation people, that's what they did. They could predict. They were on the lookout for another mule. And this is one of the things about Cleo Dynamics, the conspiratorial aspect of it, that some people are criticizing and saying, okay, these guys who are running these programs and making these and are in these think tanks doing this, they know how to manipulate things. What do you think about that?
Well, one could certainly say, and I think mostly so, the same thing about the founders of macroeconomics. Having discovered macroeconomics, they were convinced that, now we can control things. We can, we can control the money supply and the interest rates and manipulate things so that they'll turn out just fine. And of course, we have been discovering that that's simply not true.
Print more money. Quick.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that won't cause inflation. So the thing is that if we look at Cleo Dynamics as we should look at macroeconomics, as a way of understanding the system, understanding social systems, then it is a useful thing and a beneficial thing. And it will allow us to make what F.A. Hayek called pattern predictions.
Absolutely.
And so pattern predictions are fine. We should expect to be able to make pattern predictions. Will there be problems in 2020? But what do those problems look like? It's hard to say. In the late 60s or early 70s, a lot of that was caused by what we could essentially call a civil war within the Democratic Party. you know, you had your Southern Democrats were fighting, you know, the Northern Democrats on
yeah.
issues of civil rights and economic justice and that sort of thing. I don't think that anybody would have exactly predicted that that's what the big deal was going to be.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that somebody said about Asimov's Foundation is that he wrote the whole book or the whole trilogy to resolve the dichotomy between socioeconomic trends versus the great man theory, because he didn't, you know, psychohistory the way he envisioned it did not take to take the great man theory into consideration. And the great man theory, as you know, was a valid theory of history before Toynbee, I think. I don't think Toynbee was that much into it, but it was a valid theory of history, like Alexander the Great, you know. Yeah, it was a great factor in history, and Genghis Khan, you know, people like Napoleon and Hitler, you know, the idea was, what would we do without these people? I mean, they're the ones that make history, and this, of course, is what Asimov, according to some critics, what Asimov wrote his whole book about was uh-oh, we have this thing all worked out, we got everything worked out, everything works except uh-oh, what do we do about a mutant with tremendous charisma?
Right.
Yeah.
What do we do? And that, now, what is Cleodynamics, how is Cleodynamics dealing with the great man theory?
Well, you know, certainly if you sort of take a look, you know, He posits that there is a tension among sort of, well, among various factors, but he focuses on three, you know, the state, the population, and on elites. Well, you know, where are the quote unquote great men and women, but in the elites. So obviously the elites play an important part. So you're going to have people making sort of disproportionate contributions to politics or the economy, so on and so forth. Yeah, and while, you know, one may say, oh, well, you know, some of these things are going to come about anyway, a lot of these things come about when they come about because of the person who was in place at that time, you know, who had the vision, the insight, and so forth. Surely physics would have been discovered without Newton, but, you know, it was discovered when it was because of Newton.
Well,
the demagogue, which is what I suppose Asimov's mule would be the ultimate demagogue, is a mutation who has telepathic charisma. But the most prominent modern version of that, of course, is Adolf Hitler. And you can say, Hitler used to say, thank God for the Jews. If they had not have existed, we would have had to invent them. But conversely, Germany in that time could have said, thank God for Hitler. If he hadn't have existed, we would have had to invent him, you know, because he personified the frustration and played upon the frustration and the anger and the resentment and the angst of the German people at that time, you know, during the Depression and after that terrible, what they suffered after the Treaty of Versailles. So he really did epitomize. So in a sense, perhaps the great man, what makes the great man great is that he can embody that, and go back to use Turchin's term, the abysma or whatever it did, whatever Khaldun, that Arabic word, the charisma of the race, you know, the charisma of the group, and he personified it. So maybe that would, I don't know. I'm trying to argue against the great man theory in a sense here, do you think that would fit? That would fit the more into the Cleo dynamic model, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there's this tension between sort of the group and sort of these big individuals who may come out of the group and may move the group. It sort of reminds me of Nietzsche's theory about the role of the chorus in the ancient Greek tragedies, that the idea was that, you know, the chorus spoke for the group, and then out of the group came the individual who was the one who then sort of makes this big cultural social change, is then punished for it, and then everybody sort of walks through the door after they've punished him. That's the tragic view of the great man idea.
The martyr, the martyr, kind of the Christ figure.
I think we all know that Constantine. Gave the Roman Empire over to Christianity because he thought it would help him control the slave population in Rome.
Right.
I think we're talking here, going down your points here, in relation to economic conditions. I think we pretty well covered that. Your last point that you had was in relation to government. Now, if government studies Cleo dynamics, and I'm sure they are at this point, and I hope not too much like the Second Foundation, do you think that Cleo dynamics does have out of these think tanks come some plans? I'd hate to use the Cowder Pippin report as an example, how do you think this might work?
Well, the government's going to be involved in a variety of ways. One, for example, is the use of regulations. Regulations are typically sold on the idea that, with these regulations, we're going to protect the consumer and we're going to protect this, that, and the other group from these evil capitalists. What regulations typically and more often do, and also this is why businesses very often push for regulations, is they actually protect the currently existing businesses. They protect the already rich from competition, from the middle class who might come up and compete with them on these things. So government regulations actually contribute to this problem through such things as regulations that make it impossible for entrepreneurs to enter the market, or at least very difficult, protecting the already wealthy, which then allows for the concentration of wealth as the middle class gets sort of scooped out. You know, the provisions of things like, you know, welfare to mollify the poor, but also then it helps to sort of build the poor as well. If your political party thinks of its constituency as the poor, you know, it's in their best interest to create as many of their constituency as possible. i.e. the poor.
Yeah.
That contributes.
Have you had the distinct pleasure of being enlightened by Paddy Chayefsky's the speech that he has, Ned Beatty delivering in Network, that classic film Network, you know, when Ned Beatty, the head of the corporation, cuts loose on the mad prophet, you know.
Right.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale.
I love that, and I would every time we get one of these people that rants and raves about the Illuminati controlling everything, and I always tell them, I say, just go to YouTube and watch Ned Beatty's speech if you want to know what it's all about.
Exactly.
Yeah, they do. And as far as the other one the other YouTube one that thinks that religion isn't motivating, that the religion isn't really the issue in the Middle East and all that, I tell them to go to YouTube and just watch
The Mad Mahdi and watch Laurence Olivier deliver his speech from his tent. You know, in Khartoum, and that one, that's a classic. And I mentioned the Cowder Pippen report, which came out. Well, actually, I think
it came out before Cleo Dynamics really got underway. That was back in Lyndon Johnson's time, the War on Poverty, and a couple of sociologists. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard about that one.
Well, the Cowder is Cowder Pippen. I'm not sure exactly how to spell it. It's a husband and wife team, and they came up with a very Marxist oriented report based on some of the stuff we've been talking about, and the conditions. And they what they were suggesting was that the government increase entitlements. Increase entitlements until the working class could no longer handle the tax burden, and the economy would then collapse, and they would guarantee everyone a living income, everyone in the country, and that of course would naturally mean that we would have to have some sort of a Marxist state. And right. they got some government they actually got some credibility with the government on this thing, and that's the sort of thing that I worry about in taking Cleo Dynamics from the think tank into
the realm of the IRS and all the rest of that. You know, that worries me. That worries me personally. And
yet at the same time, I don't think we have to have some form of socialism these days. The world is just too complex, and economies are too complex. We can't survive without it. And just retaining personal freedom and privacy and all that's the, you know, the thing that we have to worry the most about, I think. I'm sure that some of the people listening are thinking that we're talking about something that we've been talking about, something that that evokes a kind of an idea of a bunch of very very bright scientific geeks controlling their destiny, and I wish somehow or other we could convince them that's not what we're trying, you know, what this is all leading to, that this should be helpful. We should use this discipline to try to solve problems like our world food situation and things like that. And some of these economic situations where, as you've been mentioning, we have to have, people have to have work. A society without work is it's just not functional. That idleness, the old Pennsylvania Dutch expression, idle hands are the devil's workshop. But people have to have something worthwhile to do. And granted, like in the Army, we could get them out painting rocks along the side of the road, stuff like that. But make work is not really this idea of creating meaningful work. What do you think about that? Do you think maybe we could the Cleo Dynamics could kind of focus in that direction? Hopefully.
Well, one thing that I hope Cleo Dynamics can help us do is to come to a better understanding of historical forces. And the interrelationships among elites, the general population, actions of the government, actions within the economy, and so forth. A lot of trends that we're seeing in the economy, I think, are opening up some real possibilities for more fulfilling work, perhaps, than we've seen in the past. We're getting more and more opportunities, work that is fulfilling to ourselves, and that other people want done. A lot of the sort of grunt work, is being taken over by computers and robots and so on and so forth. And we're getting a lot more mechanized, and I think that's generally good. At the same time, we have to expect this is going to be sort of a, to use Schumpeter's term, creative destruction. take Uber, for example.
Referring back to science fiction again, Frank Herbert in his Dune, which is not quite as significant as the Foundation series, but in his Dune series, he postulated a revolt against machines and against computers, and the idea is anti-technological revolt based upon the fact that people need something to do, and so the idea Herbert had was that they overthrew the machines because the machines were dehumanizing them, and then they decided they were going to do everything the machines were doing people were going to learn to do, including computer skills. And, so they developed a class of mentats who were so highly trained that they could use their brains as computers. One almost feels like, in a way, that at this point, that maybe we should consider de-technologizing ourselves to some degree, and just to give, frankly, to give people meaningful work to do, we've made things so easy for ourselves that we now have no meaningful jobs. What are your thoughts on that idea?
Well, I don't know about you, but I don't think putting the same bolt into the same place for 8 hours straight every day of every week of every month of every year is meaningful work.
I agree with you there. You know what happened in the automobile?
I think the robot could do that.
Yeah, well, a robot could certainly do that, yes, but Henry Ford, I'm glad you brought that up because I just saw a Charlie Chaplin movie, an old Charlie Chaplin movie in which he satired that whole process, and satired it. Yeah, the Henry Ford was driving people insane with his assembly lines. He literally was.
And that's why you had to pay him so much.
But now, as a result of all of that, our auto workers before our whole automobile industry just about collapsed. Our auto workers were becoming master assemblers. They each worker would go all around learning to do all of the you know, he eventually put every bolt and every hole in the whole chassis. You know, and that way he it was a lot more fulfilling assembling cars. And it's that we can take that approach to some of these jobs. We could. I'm not anti-technology myself. I know. I know Zandria thinks sometimes that I am, but I'm not. I'm not really that anti-technology. But I do think that our technology is to some degree dehumanizing, and that does worry me. And I do think that we should think about creating jobs where we are independent, where we don't have to import all our shoes from China. We should have an American shoemaking industry, and we should somewhere in the United States. We should be making everything we need in one way or another. I think that would be make it stronger, and it would recover the old idea of learning a trade and all of that. But I don't know. I'm being idealistic. And yet at the same time, I really do. There's a part of me that kind of identifies with the, you know, with the Second Foundation and I, you know, all that. Yeah, let me share something with you that you may not know. That Barbara de Grimston, the woman who took over from her husband. The infamous Process Church of the Final Judgment, which you may never have heard of, they terrified people back in the 1970s, prowling around in their black robes with their Alsatian dogs and whatever, and they were an offshoot of Scientology. Barbara de Grimston, who eventually ran the process, she was courting Isaac Asimov. And she changed the name of Process Church of the Final Judgment to the Foundation.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I have a friend who was involved in that, and I asked him about that, and he got kind of embarrassed about that. You know, I said, well, you know, but that, yeah, interesting though that she changed the name of Process Church of the Final Judgment of the Foundation. Anyway, Dr. Kaplan, thanks so much for being on board, and you really have given us a good perspective on this, and you know, give a lot of food for thought, and thanks, as I say, so much for being with us. Next week we're gonna have another mind-bending show on a similar subject, and I won't reveal what it is right now, but I'll send the abstract out. And meanwhile, everybody, you take care, be well, and good magic.
Thank you very much for having me.